Well, thank you very much, David, for setting up this wonderful meeting and setting the bar so high for this performance. Try not to trip on it. Anyway, I also actually really want to thank Anirvan for giving such a good introduction to my talk that if I'd had time, I would have given a completely different talk. But I think, you know, the point that Anirvan raised is the one that I want to really hammer on here. And even though, you know, what I'm saying may sound, you know, hauntingly familiar after what you just heard from Anirvan, when you think about it, you haven't heard a lot of talks like Anirvan's. And of course, I mean that in a completely good way. So that talk lived in the subject that I really do want to emphasize, which is the subject of synaptic diversity as a large, unexplored, except by Anirvan, territory that I believe is going to be extremely important to the future of neuroscience. So while we're on this slide, I want to point out the names of the people who actually did most of the work I'll be talking about, and the special reference to Kristina Masheva, who is the co-inventor of the technique that generated almost all the results that I'll be showing you and that I'll talk about at length. And I'll actually mention that my wife, Joanne Buchanan, planted the little idea in Christina's brain and mine that led to this technique, which I do think is pretty cool. And all of these people contributed very substantially to what you'll see. And then these are the nice people who gave us enough money to do what we wanted to do. Okay, so here's the title, and you know, we can pick that apart a little bit, single synapse analysis. Well, you know, that's something that in this day and age is pretty obvious. I mean, I think everyone in the room is well aware of what single channel analysis did for electrophysiology. And we, you know, borrowed this linguistic construction precisely to try to, you know, bask in the glow of single channel analysis. But, you know, if you look at the fields of chemistry and actually a lot of areas of imaging these days, it's all about single molecule analysis, single molecule localization. And, you know, so if you're having a hard time when you get up in the morning figuring out what to do, you take a good look at your field and figure out what the single thing in it is, the elemental thing. And if it's not already well known, you could just probably rotely have a very productive day by going after that single thing. Always a good idea. And then we've got this word diversity. Sometimes, I know, I'll admit, sometimes it's a better idea than others, but and you know, maybe the jury is still out on single synapse analysis, but frankly, I'm pretty confident that they'll let us off in the end. Okay, so here's that subject of diversity and a little list of the topics that I want to hit on, although not necessarily exactly in that order. So I'm going to begin with a somewhat lengthy introduction to and overview of the subject of synaptic diversity. This is the part that, you know, Anirvan got us off to a roaring start on. But, you know, especially for those of you who don't think about synapse molecular biology every day, I decided to leave these slides in. It may be a worthwhile introduction. Then I'm going to talk a little bit about barrel cortex. But on the other hand, that has been so elegantly introduced by David Kleinfeld that I'm going to try to keep that short. But that is happens to be our chosen model system, our microcosm in which we are now studying synaptic diversity. And then I will give you a little, actually a little in between times here, a guided tour of the barrel cortex as seen through the prism of array tomography. And then I will come back and tell you in somewhat more detail what this array tomography thing actually is, for those of you who don't know yet. And then This stuff down here is what we are currently aspiring to do with array tomography, applying it to the barrel cortex and looking at synaptic diversity. And this is just a progress report, some work that is beginning, but I think, you know, some interesting proofs of principle and some starts. Excuse me? Oh, the male, yeah. The male, good idea, yeah, since we're hooked up to the sound. Thank you for not being completely oblivious to that. Okay. We will be using the sound later, hopefully. Okay. Now here's a slide I don't want to belabor too much. This is actually the introduction to the introduction, the part about synaptic diversity. But I mean, here's an idea, a phrase that is a little bit in the air these days. People are talking about reverse engineering the brain, borrowing a concept that's probably even older than integrated circuits. But you know, there's a certain drill for reverse engineering, you know, other companies' integrated circuits, so you can figure out their tricks and secrets. And actually, in this day and age, the people who make the integrated circuits put spoofs in it specifically to make the integrated circuit hard to reverse engineer. But I think silicon engineers will never hold a candle to biology when it comes to making things hard to reverse engineer. The part that's kind of, what you do with these things, huh? We can have a discussion after I'm all done about intelligent design. The typical approach to reverse engineering one of these things is first you grind it up little by little and learn as much as you can about the structure of it, and then based on that, doing some physiology experiments on it, hooking up electrodes and logic analyzers to it. And over the years, microprocessors, this is one or several of them, have gotten pretty complicated wiring diagrams. They interconnect a billion or more transistors in one of these little packages, so that's a pretty big number and pretty challenging. But there's some things that make this kind of reverse engineering far simpler than this kind. And one of them is that the component list, the types of components in these things, you can sort them various different ways, but in any case, almost no matter how you denominate the components in an integrated circuit, you could enumerate them on the fingers of one or at most two hands. And then, of course, we know quite a bit about what whoever designed that chip was thinking. Okay, in the case of the brain, the numbers are bigger, the kilometers of wire is bigger, everything is packed in 3D. So extracting the wiring diagram is going to be a lot harder. Clay Reed gave you a very nice taste of the state of the art in attempts to acquire the data so that we can begin to put together wiring diagrams. And I think all of you who are at Clay's talk understand that there's a good chance that we'll learn a lot from this approach, but that there's a long ways left to go. But now, the part highlighted in magenta here really sets the theme for my talk. There's besides the fact that there's a lot of wires in there and they're densely packed in 3D, and problem aside from this one, and that is that the list of components in there is very, very long. As a minimum, we could take the 20,000 protein encoding genes roughly in a mouse or human genome and observe that just about all of those genes, all of those proteins are present in the brain. And actually, it's quite a bit worse than that because there's all kind of alternative splice variants and stuff like that. Instead of a list of four components, we have a list of who knows how many. Maybe 95% of those 20,000 proteins are quotes, housekeeping genes, and we can safely ignore them. Maybe it'll turn out that way in the end, but actually nobody knows for sure of a single protein that it's safe to ignore in the brain. We just don't know enough yet. So there's this vast parts list. And as if the protein components weren't bad enough, there are many, many metabolites, some of which we've known and loved for a long time, such as neurotransmitters, energy intermediates, and our favorite energy intermediate, ATP. Well, it's more than just that. It's a very important modulator in the brain. Matters a lot to how brains work. So, you know, this is the problem we're going to talk about today. And then, you know, the overarching problem is that we don't really have the foggiest idea of what the design rules are. We can make up some simplifications, but we don't know nearly enough to know they're right. We don't even know that there are design rules. I mean, unfortunately, this thing wasn't designed by a sensible human engineer. It was designed by a complete, profligate, promiscuous maniac known as evolution, in my particular view of the world. Okay, so synaptic diversity. Come at this as in a sort of historical way. Here is a photograph of one of the actual Ramoni Cajal slides of neurons stained with Golgi, and sort of our first serious glimpse, the first glimpse of the synapse that was taken seriously is represented in this little picture over here. So this is where you look at one of these slides and you zoom in with the very best microscope available, and Cajal had it, and Golgi didn't, and that's probably part of the reason that Cajal was right and Golgi was wrong. A really good microscope, you see these little things that we know today as dendritic spines. Cajal originally called them dendritic thorns in some different language. But anyway, these are the classical version, I guess, of the very fancy thorny excrescences that Miriam showed us so elegantly before. But anyway, Cajal saw these things, and he imagined that those were the sites of singular contacts onto the cell. And, you know, after another couple decades, those contacts came to be known as synapses. But it turns out that this exact method, Golgi staining, looking at these things, interpreting them as useful surrogates of individual synapses, remains a major industry. There are companies that do nothing but take specimens from pharmaceutical companies, for instance, and Golgi stain them and look at pictures just like this and count up the thorns. And there are, you know, hundreds of papers every year based on such analysis. And what the consistent usefulness of looking at dendritic spines, even in this very thing of Golgi stained specimens, bears testament to is the fact, you know, it's that thing I said at the beginning about getting up in the morning and counting the elementary level thing. This was our first and only hook, first and for a very long time only hook at the individual synapse. Okay, the next major progress, which began in the 1930s, culminated in the 1980s, was also an indication of synaptic diversity. So this was the discovery, first there was this big battle raging about whether synapses were chemical or electrical, and the answer was both, but you know, most attention to this very day now focuses on the chemical ones, and the chemical ones are so-called because they use the release of a metabolite or a small peptide at the synapse to send the signal across it. I'm sure you're all familiar with this, but you know, between the 20s and the 80s, a substantial list of different small molecule metabolites, a much longer list of peptides that work in somewhat similar ways was accumulated. The capstone in this effort was the last one of all. I guess that's the right way to put in a capstone. The final consensus was reached in the 80s that glutamate was, in fact, the main excitatory neurotransmitter in the brain. It was hiding out for a good long time, but the English chemists took care of it by coming up with a bunch of useful analogs, agonists, antagonists. So, the canonical number today is that roughly 90% of the synapses in the brain use glutamate as the neurotransmitter. And here's, you know, the first and, you know, perhaps most fundamental axis of synaptic diversity, the one that's widely accepted and well known. Now, for the rest of this talk, when I talk about synaptic diversity, I'm not talking about this. This is a done deal. I'm talking about, for instance, digging in any one of these categories. And, you know, my bottom line is going to be that there is some vast number of different kinds of glutamate synapses in the brain, and that, you know, maybe some of the differences don't matter, but many of them do. And you know, again, I'll refer back to Anirvan's talk. I mean, he was talking almost exclusively about glutamatergic synapses there, and he was giving you a very fine analysis of it. Now, there's plenty of room to apply the same treatment to the GABAergic synapses. There's different kinds of them. We don't know quite as much about it yet, but we'll be concentrating here on the glutamatergic type. So, you know, the idea is to take that category and explore its diversity. Think about it a little bit. Now, for some of you, this will be very familiar old hat, but I suspect for others it won't. So we'll go through this quickly, but I'm going to go through it. Next big breakthrough was the perfection, probably isn't too strong a word, the near perfection of the art of electron microscopy in the 50s and 60s, so that by the 60s, people examining central nervous system tissue were finding synapses that looked like this. So there are many characteristic features here. There's a synaptic cleft. There's some kind of discernible density or specialization on both sides of the synapse. There's a big cloud of, you know, generally speaking, hundreds of synaptic vesicles, these little things here. And then many synapses in the CNS are formed onto a dendritic thorn or a dendritic spine. And this kind of actual observation led to this cartoon, which should be familiar to almost everyone. The nerve impulse comes along and something happens. Calcium goes into the presynaptic terminal. It triggers a membrane fusion event, and neurotransmitter is released from the contents of the vesicle and goes over and does stuff. We now understand lots of different stuff, actually, to the postsynaptic cell. But part of it is to contribute to the generation of a new action potential. So that's, you know, kind of the fundamental signaling nexus in these things that we call neuronal networks. Okay, so that's kind of where things stood up until the cornucopia of molecular biology, molecular genetics, broke the composition of this thing open. And there's still many questions, but at least we have, you know, the grand cast of characters. We don't always know which ones go where, but we've learned a lot about these characters. So bit by bit of the synapse, here's the synaptic vesicle cloud. Here is a recent attempt at an anatomically correct version of a single synaptic vesicle. There's a lipid membrane, that's the gray green stuff. And then there's all these squirrely things, which are, you know, mostly based on known dimensions and crystal structures in this cartoon. A whole bunch of different kinds of molecules. The molecules that, you know, regulate the reaction triggered by calcium where the vesicle fuses, and the ones that reload the vesicle with neurotransmitter, and the ones that are the powerhouses for the reloading process, and many other things that we only barely glimpse the significance of. But my point is here, even, you know, the humble little synaptic vesicle has many, many different proteins on it. Dozens of different species, hundreds of copies of a few, one copy of one, several copies of most of them. There's a lot of proteins there. So it's not just a simple little round ball, it's a big, hairy, complicated thing with lots of protein molecules and lots of potential for diversity. Same could be said of the lipids in it, actually. Okay, moving on, there's this thing that we saw beginning in the 50s and 60s, a little bit of fuzz. Molecular biologists have begun to dissect that. Protein chemists have looked at interactions between proteins, and this represents a recent attempt to indicate the network of physical interactions and signaling connections that regulate the activity of the presynaptic active zone. And whoops, it's not just a simple little fuzzy thing. It's, you know, same story, something composed of dozens of different molecules and, you know, varying copy numbers of each. Okay, now we're at the part that was really the star of Onervan's talk, I think, the synaptic cleft itself. You know, it's not just the gap between two cells. I mean, all along we could see there was some stringy stuff there. But now we understand that there is a major alphabet soup of molecules. And these are the kinds of molecules that Onervan, he told us about some of these. I'm sure in Onervan's lab, they're thinking about all of them. He wouldn't have been able to tell you that nice story if they hadn't been thinking about all these molecules. Some of them are thought of as adhesion molecules. Others are thought of as signaling molecules. This is where we know the diversity gets really huge, and we believe that that diversity is fundamental in ways that Onervan represented for you to the correct assembly of nervous systems, so the specificity that gets the right neurons connected to the right other neurons. So this is, you know, probably the most important side of that. So you can think of these as, and they often are, or I should say were, thought of as developmental or guidance molecules, you know, important for development. But the picture that's emerging is very few of them go away when development is over, if development is ever really over. So these molecules tend to persist at synapses. And there tends to be a lot of them. This is where the numbers of splice variants really gets astronomical. Okay, but we're still not done. Then there's the postsynaptic signaling complexes. And we used to think, oh, you know, what's the glutamate receptor? Now we know there's dozens of subunits. They can combine in various different combinations. They can do very, very different things. They can come and go in the, literally almost in the blink of an eye. You know, this is where much of the current thinking about plasticity focuses on the this complex, taking into account that it's dynamic and different receptors can come in and out of the membrane with amazing dozens of signaling molecules. A phosphate group here can rip it apart, put it back together, turn it on, turn it off. But again, dozens of molecules. And that's still not all, because then there's a bunch of sort of trafficking and storage warehouse machinery in these dendritic spines or otherwise near synapses that you know, might be the site of reserve, temporarily inactivated receptors and other signaling molecules, and these things are cycling in and out of the synapse. So to sort of summarize, there are many important dimensions of synaptic diversity. So far, hit on the molecular ones, because that's the one that our new tool is particularly good for looking at. But you know, here is just a, you know, a very, in broad categories, the kinds of molecules that we know are present in synapses. And I've titled this molecular diversity because, you know, the right way to put this, I think, is that, you know, there's very few molecules in those categories that do not exist in multiple isoforms and are not patterned in the way their genes are expressed. That is, some cells express one isoform or one gene, other cells express other ones. And the more gene expression, we get to be patterned and diverse. And, you know, I refer to Onervan's talk. You know, there are you know, some isoforms, some splice variants in CA3 cells, some in CA1, and, you know, certainly for development they make a big difference, and oh, by the way, they don't go away when development is over. Now there are other aspects of diversity that, you know, we have to care just as much about. There's structural diversity, there's big synapses, and there's small signals synapses. And we understand that size matters, and that, you know, the big ones tend to be stronger, the small ones tend to be weaker. Chuck's lab had a very beautiful pioneering paper on this subject a few years ago. But, you know, the structural diversity extends into many dimensions that we, you know, barely grasped. I mean, you know, you saw, you know, one pole of the weirdness zoo in Onervan's EM reconstructions. But I mean, this is my point. When you start looking, you know, when you look with techniques like Onervan applied there to different kinds of synapses, or actually, if you just sit down at a good old-fashioned electron microscope and start, you know, looking at what's there, you see there's all kinds of structural diversity. You don't know what the hell it means. But you know what? It would be very unsafe to say that it doesn't matter, and we don't. There's no science of it at this point, other than a few little oases like the one Anirvan talked about. Now, in some ways, what we care about the most is the functional diversity. And we know for sure from reading the physiological literature that synapses are diverse. People talk about release probability, facilitation. I mean, the science of synaptic physiology is very much about diversity. There's plasticity. Plasticity is, one way of summarizing what plasticity means is it's the way that synapses can change. We believe that the functional plasticity of the brain is mainly due to changes that happen at synapses. Now, some of those changes are very drastic, like a new synapse is formed, an old one is eliminated. Others, we believe, are more subtle. They are, changes in the molecular composition of the synapse and so on. Functional diversity in the end matters very much. My hunch is that molecular diversity and the study of molecular diversity because of some special advantages that apply to it is going to be the key someday to understanding structural and functional diversity. Although, it's certain to be an interactive kind of thing. David. Well, yes. I mean, you can find such places, but what if exactly this complicated, annoying stuff is the very heart and essence of what lets our cerebral cortex think about synapses in the first place? I mean, simpler. The idea of simple can often be misleading. Any organism living on the face of the earth has been undergoing continuous evolution since the beginning of biological time, and maybe becoming more fit, more adapted, and perhaps even more inscrutable as it goes along. So, C. elegans has been through millions of times more generations than we have. We're going to talk about, there are places to do that. I think the place where this is going to be most naked and easy to figure out is in the cerebral cortex, because this is kind of the latest and the newest neural structure. It's had the least time to bury its secrets. It's undergone a rapid evolution. I think the mammalian cortex is the simple system. Yes. Well, they're part of, that's right. I mean, the life of a cell as we know it is inconceivable without them. The problem here, I mean, there is a place for looking for the simplest possible system, but the subject of this talk is the diversity that is a given for thinking about, and in my case, the cerebral cortex. So, there might be very valuable lessons to be learned with jellyfish and worms. But I think, this topic, if you're interested in the cerebral cortex, I think you have to be interested in this topic. So that's why I want to talk about it. Okay, so the single synapse analysis tools. Well, I already introduced spine analysis and electron microscopy. Those are good. They have stood us in very good stead, but neither one of them gives us very much molecular information. And I think in this day and age, one of the main tools we have is molecules for, better understanding function and things like diversity. The physiology is absolutely fundamental. The challenge, as I would see it, to physiologists today, to synaptic physiologists, is to try to find ways to study single synapses. They are actually few and far between. Now, you might think of the frog neuromuscular junction. Not quite a single synapse. It's actually a parallel array of hundreds of single synapses. The squid giant synapse, a parallel array of 10,000 synapses. Now, those synapses are probably you know, relatively homogeneous as opposed to diverse, but even so, the dynamics of the individual elemental release site are hidden by the fact that at the frog neuromuscular junction, the calyx of Held, the squid giant synapse, the list goes on and on, you're actually studying parallel arrays of a large number of synapses. And there are exceedingly few experimental techniques to date that have unequivocally studied the function of an individual synapse, an individual active zone. And I think that is actually a very important experimental challenge. However, I worry that without the ability to denominate and classify synapses in molecular terms, studying individual synapses is going to be very confusing. You know, if you've only got the physiology without sort of the prior hook of knowing something about the molecular composition or the molecular type of the synapse, maybe you'll see a lot of variability and you'll say, oh, well, it's just variability. And you'll be missing the fact that it's variability that is intimately foretold by the molecular characteristics of the synapse. So actually, I think, you know, what's going to be very important is putting, I'm going to spend the rest of this talk talking about ways of doing the proteomics of individual synapses. But one of the reasons that I am so interested in this topic and I'm working so hard on it, and my whole lab is because of, I think, the fundamental importance to the interaction between physiology at the single synapse level and proteomics at the single synapse level that the future, I predict, will bring us. Okay, so we've heard a lot about the barrel cortex. I think with apologies to those of you who weren't able to be here for David Kleinfeld's talk, I will not say too much to introduce it. It's just, I'll just say this. A lot of us, I think David thinks this, I think this, probably other people in the room, and lots of the world's best physiologists, think that this particular piece of cortex and this particular rodent is the Rosetta Stone, which will enable us to understand human consciousness. Okay. Having said that, I'll spare my SETI section that one. Okay, so here's a little icon. So this is sagittal or coronal, I don't even remember which section, through the barrel cortex. And this is a little tiny thumbnail sketch made from some array tomography, and we will use this as an icon to sort of navigate the cortex many times in this talk. So I want to give you a second to kind of get used to it. You'll see an obvious tendency to be layered. The layers were described by the 19th century histologists. They got it right. This part up here is what we call gray matter. It's sitting on some white matter. This is one of the giant input-output cables, the bundles of axons projecting from the large projection neurons in this cortex, in this piece of cortex, and projecting to this piece of cortex from large projection axons somewhere else, like in other parts of the cortex or in the thalamus. And then there's something below the white matter. And in much of the barrel cortex, it's the striatum, a very interesting part of the brain in its own right. But anyway, this is the part we're studying. And the idea here is we have very good reason to believe, based on various lines of evidence, that there are lots of different kinds of synapses here. We know for sure there's lots of kinds of different cells. And just taking the logic that Anirvan articulated so, you know, impressively in his talk. You know, lots of different cells. They're wired up in particular ways. There must be lots of different kinds of synapses there. It's only one of the arguments. Okay, so we're about to take a little tour. We're going to fly into one of those pieces of cortex using array tomography. And I'll make a very brief introduction and then come back in a little while to the more interesting, you know, more interesting detailed version. The etymology of the word tomography is just about slice writing. It's an old, comes from the Greek. And arrays, as you'll see, it makes use of arrays of sections. So the basic idea is to take a three-dimensional piece of tissue that might be kind of hard to get at with staining chemicals, hard to get at with powerful microscopes, and physically section it, cut ultra-thin serial sections, very much nearly exactly like electron microscopists have been doing for over 50 years. And then the part that's sort of new is we figured out a pretty good way to arrange those serial sections in stable two-dimensional arrays, which in fact are on a solid substrate, a glass cover slip, a really good thing to have something be on if you want to look at it with a good microscope. So we build a two-dimensional array, we stain it, you get very good chemical access because everything is laid out in 2D and the diffusion distances are very short, and we image it because most microscopes do really well at imaging something in one plane that's all nicely in focus and where you can correct all the aberrations, and they go to hell when you get away from that focal plane and they have really bad resolution along the Z-axis and so on. So take a whole bunch of two-dimensional pictures, and that's where things would stop without Moore's law and modern computation. But thanks to Moore's law and modern computation, they don't need and huge disk drives, like Clay was talking about. It doesn't stop there. So now what we can do is we can take those huge stacks of two-dimensional images and computationally align them and turn them into volume image vectors and do all kinds of neat tricks and look at them lots of different ways. And so that's kind of what we're going to spend the rest of our time doing here. So here's our little navigator icon again, the six layers of the cortex. And just for a sense of scale, from here to here is 1.5 millimeters. There's a little magenta rectangle up here, and I'll use this sort of graphic conceit over and over again. The molecular rectangle represents the part of the volume image that is enlarged and rendered to fill the screen. So you can probably see that right there. Here's this little stalk of celery sticking up. Oh yeah, yes. I meant to say that. Okay. The color schemes will come and go, except, okay, so what's all this green stuff here? This is as good a place as any to talk about it. So this is the famous workhorse of in vivo imaging, the Thi-1 line H YFP mouse that was the work of Woping Fong in Jeff Lichtman and Josh Sane's lab in the waning years of the 20th century. They published this one in 1999, along with a whole bunch of other transgenics that they got. They kept doing the same thing over and over again, and every time they did it, they got a different wonderful mouse out. And those mice are working hard in laboratories all over the world. This is probably the number one champion. This is the same kind of mouse, you know, Clay called it line H mouse, I'll call it line H mouse. The mouse that was in brain number 8, volume number 8, mouse number 8 was one of these kind of mice. Okay, so what's going on? Well, here's our little low mag sketch. Here's the layers of the cortex. In layer 5B, you'll see a bunch of nice big bright green spots. So those are the cell bodies of a subset of the layer 5B pyramidal cells that express YFP. That subset of cells are the kind that have the big giant tufts up in layer 1. That's why you see, here we're looking at layer 1 and you see this dense thicket here. That is mostly the apical tufts of those very dendrites that you see coming out of those cells in layer 5B. Although mixed in with them, there are axons, perhaps some recurrent local axons, and the terminal arbors of axons that started off, you know, across the street over there at this scale in the other hemisphere. So in this picture right here, the green is expression of YFP. As you can see, there's a lot of stuff in this volume, but this you're probably only seeing about 3% of what's actually there. There's a lot of cells labeled, but it's only about 3% of the cells. The other 97% are not expressing YFP, and under the conditions of rendering you see here, they are totally invisible. So that empty space, you know, in your mind, yeah, there's a lot of wires there, there's dendrites, there's axons, but whatever you see there, multiply it by about 30 and, you know, envision what this volume really looks like. And I'll give you a little help at envisioning that as we go along. But I want to make a couple more comments that will apply here and then to many other renderings that we'll be looking at as we go along. First off, the big fat things up here in the layers of the cortex that you'll see are mainly dendrites. When we get down below, we'll see some big fat myelinating projection axons. But up here, dendrites. And you can kind of, you know, at this low mag, you can see spines on them. We'll take a much closer look at spines as we go along. So these are dendrites, apical tufts. And then there's another kind of thing, sort of more randomly tortuous, little thin things with periodic wide spots, boutons. Those are axons. And we don't know exactly where they came from, but the ones that we see, one thing we can be sure of is they came from YFP-expressing cells, you know, either in this piece of cortex, in the thalamus, someplace else in the cortex, or somewhere else. So this is what axons, what fine terminal arbors and synaptic fields tend to look like. Lots of boutons as they make their en passant synapses and coursing in willy-nilly paths. Now, something that's probably very obvious, maybe even upsetting to some of you, is very obvious that many of these dendrites begin and end abruptly in the middle of nowhere. Same is true for the axons. It's a little harder to see it. Here's a dendrite, and I guarantee you that dendrite was on its way to elaborate into a big, beautiful apical tuft up here, but it never got the chance because this volume that was acquired is, you know, pretty big. 10 gigabyte volume, 1.5 millimeters, about 0.5 millimeters in the full extent, but it's only 12 microns thick for pretty much the same reason that Clay's volume from mouse number 8 was only 50 microns thick. Only, you know, I have to admit we didn't work a billionth as hard as Clay to get our 12 microns. But anyway, this volume has lots of stuff in it, but it's thin in the direction projecting in and out of the screen, only 12 microns. So wherever you see something that appears to begin or end abruptly, it's because it came out the front of the volume or went out the back of it. Everybody comfortable with that concept? Okay, so now we can take a little better look at this. This is a three-dimensional volume. You know, the idea was this was stained and imaged as an array of 2D sections and then computationally reconstructed. And it just turns out that the computational alignment just works extremely well. There's some minor warping in the sections as they're collected, but it's very easy to remove those by the computational alignment procedure. It's fully automated and, in our hands, completely trouble-free. I mean, it does, you know, it sucks up a lot of processor cycles. If we had to do it with a hand crank calculator, I wouldn't be talking about it that way. But since we, you know, do it with the help of 2010 Intel chips, it's pretty easy. So this is layer 1 and 2. Now, here's a little bit of help at visualizing what's actually there. So took the same green channel, that was the YFP fluorescence. Actually, no immunostaining necessary there. We've sort of perfected a set of techniques that keeps the native fluorescence of YFP alive. But now the blue that we're seeing here, you can't really read it. The blue is a stain for acetylated tubulin. So inside every axon and every dendrite, there is a bundle of microtubules, which is fundamental to the existence of that axon and dendrite. It's the railroad tracks for the axonal transport. It's the structural armature for it. And in stable microtubules that have been around for a while, the tubulin tends to get acetylated. So this was a antibody that recognizes especially those stable long microtubules in the cores of axons and dendrites. So what this is giving you a look at is the other 97% of apical dendrites that happen to be sitting in this locale. And, you know, if they were all stained the same, they would all be pretty and green and sharp, but the volume would be a blaze of light and you wouldn't be able to see anything. You'd have a heck of a segmentation problem rendering it out. But, you know, this is something to think about when you think about what the insides of a brain look like. The artists' renderings we've been showing each other over the years tend to be much sparser because the artist got tired long before they drew in enough branches and dendrites, and because the artist would have the same problem. You put too much stuff there, you kind of lose the essence of it. But evolution didn't care about expressing the evidence. It didn't care about anything, but the results of its work were to produce something in less than 1.5 liters that can write poetry, create physics, math, astronomy, and cell biology. Okay, now another little thing I'll point out that you'll see over and over again. Actually, maybe we can see it a little better. Okay, now we're going to take away the microtubules and put in the synapses. So here's the synapses at approximately that density of 1 per cubic micron, 1 billion per microliter. These little red spots, and actually the reason I'm talking about all this work is those spots are fully resolved, enumeratable, measurable in 3D by this technique. And it's actually something very new to have an optical technique that can resolve things that are so closely spaced. So in this case, the red is an indirect immunofluorescence signal from synapsin 1. So synapsin 1 is a vesicle-associated protein. It's not part of the vesicle. It can come on and off, but it sort of forms the matrix. You know, I showed you the way the vesicles are in a cloud. Synapsin has something to do with holding them in that cloud and then letting go of them. It's a phosphoprotein. Very interesting stuff. We have come to love it because after looking very carefully and writing papers on the subject and everything, we've come to the conclusion that this particular protein, synapsin 1, is the closest of any single protein marker to highlighting all the synapses and only the synapses. You might think of other things that would have to be present in all synapses, like certain synaptic vesicle proteins. But it turns out that with the antibodies we've got to them, they recognize those other synaptic vesicle proteins in various intermediate way stations and transport packets on the routes of synthesis, degradation. When you look at them with a 2-photon, it's really obvious they're moving around. They couldn't really be synapses, and they lack the full complement of markers. So this is a single marker. We're going to talk about how we use multiple markers to validate our interpretation. But for the purposes of this tour, each of those little red spots is a synapse. Now, most of them appear to be hanging there in empty space because only 3% of the cells show up. But I can pretty much assure you that every one of them, of those red spots, is attached between a presynaptic cell and a postsynaptic cell. It's just that 97% of them are invisible. And we'll take a closer look to make this more convincing. Yes. Yes, that's the next thing I wanted to introduce. So you'll see that over and over again. You see these little pock marks all over the place. So those are where there were cell bodies. Many of them are neuronal cell bodies. Some of them are glial cell bodies. There's places where you'll see cell bodies of cells associated with the blood vessels and so on. But think of them as neurons. Those are the invisible neurons, and there's no synapses inside the neuronal cell body because, well, that's just the way it is. And so that's why you see them as voids. Okay, and then on with our tour. Now we're down in layer 5A. So this is a region of major input to those layer 5B pyramidal cells, the ones you see in green. So there's, fire this one up. Layer 5B, there's the cell bodies would be right below this. And what you can see are these big, fat, fairly proximal segments. It's a little bit higher magnification. You can see the dendritic spines better and better. And you can see the weave of those little spider webby axons in there. Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, it's in these cells, this is what it looks like in layer 5B. Now, layer 5A.
Yeah.
You'll get another chance to see this later, but it's going to be a while later. Those those collateral branches are gone up in layer 4. Or they're not gone, but there's far fewer of them. You wouldn't worry about the impedance load. But I mean, this is the way it is in layer 5A. Layer 5A. And then here's painting in the synapses. Now you can begin to see that basically every single one of those dendritic spines has a little red blob of synapsin on top of it. Okay, so just to finish our little tour, here's layer 5B. So now we can see the cell bodies of the YFP expressors. And you know, there's a lot of basal dendrites and collaterals here. It gets even thicker, perhaps. And you know, here we're enriched. You know, it's not 3% of the cells here. It's probably 40% or 25% of the cells here. There's still plenty of empty space. There's the synapses. And then the next picture, besides being our candidate for cover of Neuron in November, is just a little icon for the fact that we can fully resolve those individual CDs and enumerate them. So that's what we did here. We enumerated them and then assigned each one a random color. So this is a pseudo quasi synaptobo mouse in the Argot of the Lichtman laboratory. Because we were in the wrong layer. You need to think back to that icon that I showed you, the navigator. The cell bodies, this is where the small subset of cell bodies that happened to have the Thi1 YFP construct land in a place in the genome where it was expressed. I mean, because not every cell. Yeah, there's only, there a lot of those empty spots here were filled with other big pyramidal cells. But you know what? There's something different about them, I would say. I mean, you know, they've all got the same Thi1 and the same locus. Some of them are expressing YFP and some of them aren't. This talk is about synaptic diversity, but it's a very close cousin to neuronal cell type diversity. And so what you're seeing is some indication of neuronal cell type diversity. And neuronal cell type diversity is way not done. I mean, we have a beginning. It's very important, but it's only the beginning. And maybe this is one little tip of that iceberg. Yes. I think it's almost the next. I will come back to that. And if I. No, this is not 2-photon. This is high-speed CCD. This is wide field, but it's imaging at the diffraction limit at NA 1.4, and you don't see that very often. Srini? They're cell biology in action. If you think the brain is complicated, you should see cell biology. I don't, it's just where the protein is starting to light up. And you know, if it was a membrane protein or something, I'd say, well, it's probably in the Golgi apparatus. But you know, it could be misfolded. Well, I think all GFP in a mammal is misfolded in a certain sense. It doesn't belong there. And so those actually might be the cell's lame attempt to remove something that doesn't smell quite right. But you know, that's pure speculation. Well, I prefer to call it Smith's principle, actually. It's sort of like Dale's law, and I think, you know, it's going to turn out to be wrong, but it's better to have your name on a principle that turns out to be wrong than to never have your name on a principle at all. Okay, now, just rounding out this tour a little bit. I know some of you wanted to see this. Now we're just going to pick one of those spines. And this, you know, I won't say this is completely at random, but it could have been. They all look something like this. So here is one of those spines zoomed in, digitally resampled in a way to perfectly simulate optical diffraction. So yeah, there were pixels there, and the pixels are big. But pixels are an artifact. I don't want to show anybody pixels. This is, you know, if you could get your eye up close enough, this is what you'd see. It's fuzzy. It's not sharp, like Anirvan's EM reconstructions, because the wavelength of photons is hideously longer than the wavelength of energetic electrons. But anyway, there's the spine as best we can see it at the NA 1.4 diffraction limit. And since we can see it pretty sharply, well, okay, I'll let you look at something. So here's some of those, some synaptic puncta. Actually, maybe I'll do this backwards. Okay, the green stuff, pardon the color changes, synapsin 1 immunofluorescence again. So the stuff we were looking at. Remember, I promised you there was a synapsin 1 doodad on the end of every dendritic spine. So here's the one for that spine. And then what we've got here is some other synaptic proteins, just a few of them for starters, to, you know, try to help make the interpretation that I have been asserting here a little more convincing. Now, what we've done here is we've rendered out a little volume, and if we rendered out everything that was in this volume, there would be synaptic puncta that have nothing to do with this cell in the way, so you wouldn't be able to see what I'm showing you. So there's a little image processing trick that at first we thought it was a trick, and then we sort of gradually figured out it was a very valuable tool, and we're starting to use it all the time. So when you have a sharply delineated cell, because that cell is expressing, you know, a fluorescent protein, or because you have injected some Lucifer yellow or some neurobiotin into that cell, and when you resolve it, the nice way array tomography resolves things in 3D, you can use 3D image analysis. You can threshold the cell, make a binary mask, and then dilate that binary mask, dilate it out so that the mask goes, you know, a half micron or a micron from the surface of the cell, and then use that to get rid of everything that of all synaptic protein puncta that aren't real close to the cell. So that's what we've done here. I'm going to come back, I'm explaining that at length because we're going to use that trick over and over again. So we've gotten rid of all of the synapses that are too far away to possibly be synapses onto this cell. However, you know, we have retained some synapses that I would say are pretty obviously not onto this cell. So we'll come back to those in just a second. But first I'm going to talk about, you know, where there's something that looks about right. So the blue is PSD95. Anirvan talked about this one. It's a postsynaptic scaffolding at most or all glutamatergic synapses. And you can see it appears to be kind of sunk into the YFP here. It should look that way because it's actually on the inside of the cell. So, you know, this looks just about right to be PSD95 on that cell. It's real close. It's you know, the PSD95 is like 25 nanometers below the surface of the cell. And of course that's the resolution limit, depending on how you define, is around 200 nanometers for NA1.4 at the diffraction limit. So they're unresolvably close. But the idea of resolution, you have to think about it a whole different way when you have multiple colors, and it's a different color. So we don't need the resolution to see that the PSD95 is separate from the spine because the PSD95 is yellow and the PSD95 is blue, and we're going to use that trick over and over again too. The red here is a protein component of the presynaptic active zone called Basun. It was one of the names in one of those hideously complicated cartoons I showed you at the beginning. But it's supposed to be in the presynaptic cell, and all it looks like what we got here is actually there's kind of two parts to the synapse on the spine, and each one of them has a blob of Basun. And the blob of Basun isn't really that big. It's dilated by diffraction. I've seen Basun other ways, and what it really is it's kind of a little plate, maybe 300 nanometers in diameter and 20 nanometers thick. But this is what that looks like when you dilate it by diffraction. But hey, you know, it's still good enough to see that it kind of matches up with the PSD95. And then when you add the synapsin, that is sort of giving you the general locus of that cloud of synaptic vesicles. Yes. I would say ambiguous is about the right word. I mean, there is a little bit of PSD95 stuck in that crotch there, and that's sort of close to it. There's other ones I think it's out of the question. Like, you know, out here, that PSD95 is in one of those invisible cells that just happen to be within our binary mask, and so it shows up here. Now, you know, as a next step in the digital image analysis, and this is the kind of thing I won't talk about too much, but we're doing it now, you can, you know, set another criterion, and you can say, okay, if the PSD95 isn't like real close to or inside the yellow or the Lucifer yellow or the, you know, the neurobiotin or whatever, then we're going to get rid of that too. So we might be interested. I'm getting ahead of myself here. I would say there's an excellent, you know, in that case, you could actually, there's a little bit of a green haze. Most of the synapsin got kind of clipped off by the mask on that one. But that is quite possibly a synapse. Okay, so we're completely done with the tour now. And now I'm going to tell you a little bit more about array tomography, just, you know, the particular tricks. And then I'm going to show you what we're doing in the way of, you know, attempting some of the high throughput analysis classification.
What about receptors? Have you tried to visualize?
Yeah. I'm about to show you some of that. So they work good, by and large. Okay, so here's the little outline of array tomography. Remember, it was planarization, 2D imaging, 3D reconstruction. So the first important detail we come to is the particular embedding resin that we use to embed the specimen. So we took this one out of the electron microscopy toolbook, but it was one of the late arrivals. During much of the history of electron microscopy, people used epoxy resins, and they're still kind of the best for producing the classic look of a good EM. But in the 70s and 80s, people discovered that acrylic resins had some nice properties, including they were much easier and more comfortable and less irritating to the human who was working with them. The EMs didn't look quite as nice, but they were okay. So, you know, they found their advocates. But then in the early 80s, somebody in Sweden discovered something really wonderful. If you cut ultra-thin sections in these acrylic resins, at least some of them, such as this one, LR White, you could take your thin section and have it, you know, on your EM grid, like Clay showed you yesterday, and then you could put an antibody solution on it. You could do, you know, some immunofluorescence. And wonder of wonders, the antibody, you know, you'd think plastic. How could an antibody go into plastic? A good enough thought. But it's not quite true, at least for the short distances at stake here, on the order of 100 nanometers. The plastic can wiggle its way into the resin matrix. So it turns out these acrylics are, number one, hydrophilic. So you can actually even you can leave some water behind. You have to mostly dehydrate the tissue. You can leave water behind. That's the trick for keeping the fluorescent protein fluorescence alive. And it allows diffusion of aqueous molecules, such as antibodies, into there. It's also very weakly cross-linked. So it forms kind of an open polymer matrix that turns out to be just open enough to let antibodies wiggle their way in. And antibodies are, you know, just the way they are, they're pretty flexible. I mean, they're, you know, you could say, oh, it's a 4-nanometer glob, but actually they're pretty flexible and hinged, and they can wiggle their way into small spaces, such as these resin matrix spots. And then if you label them, if you satisfy yourself to label them with small organic fluors, such as alexidize, the fluor goes along for the ride. If you want to get fancy and put a quantum dot on them, they'll never get in. Quantum dot's just too big to wiggle into the resin matrix. So that's cool. At the same time, that resin matrix does a very good, not perfect, but very good job of stabilizing the tissue protein through all kinds of abuse. So there's this, you know, the enigma here that I'll leave you to think about or ask you about at the end is that the resin matrix holds the tissue protein in, but lets the antibodies go in and, as you'll see in a minute, out. Okay, so that part's important. Now this is a close-up of an electron microscopist's main tool other than their electron microscope itself at work. So this is an ultramicrotome, a real-time video. The specimen embedded in the plastic is that little shiny dome you can kind of just barely make out there, I hope. And so that plastic has a piece of, you know, fluorescent mouse cortex embedded in it, and it's been neatly trimmed, and it's moving in a very smooth, precise way, and scraping, cutting that block against the edge of a diamond knife. So the diamond knife there very, very closely approximates a single row of carbon atoms. It's a very wonderful thing. It's very, very sharp, very, very strong, and This machine can sit there all day long, and if you set the little dial at 50 nanometers, it cuts off 50 nanometer thick pieces of plastic. And then we used some special tricks, not new tricks, old tricks. We dug them out of the history books. We used some old tricks to make it so one individual section is wide and short. We'll get a better picture of it in a minute. But the trick makes it so that as each section is cut, it is perfectly and reliably butt spliced to the section before it. So as this machine cycles approximately every 5 seconds, what it's actually doing is producing a ribbon that gets longer and longer. And we often grow these ribbons to about 40 millimeters. And then we have to call it quits, because that's as big as we can fit on our microscope. Actually, Clay showed you similar ribbons. Epoxies spontaneously form ribbons. This acrylic, because it's hydrophilic, you have to use special tricks. But you know, we let the ribbons grow and grow and grow, because we're not going to put them on those little 3 millimeter EM grids that Clay showed you. Yeah, okay, so here's, it happens with some help. And so here's the help. So this is a close-up. Here's that diamond knife, just a little close-up on one little section of the diamond knife as it cuts the block. And the special, yeah, we trim the block very, very precisely. We have a little diamond cutting tool, so the top and the bottom are very flat and very parallel. And then we put some sticky glue on the top and the bottom. It's actually just contact cement from the hardware store, and we thin it down about 10 to 1 with an organic solvent and paint it on with a tiny little camel's hair brush. There's got to be a better way, but you know, it works. So, okay, so the top and the bottom of the block are kind of sticky. And what happens is when one cutting stroke is finished, the block goes down, pulls away, recycles, and gets ready to do it again. The trailing edge of the section you just cut is left there lightly adhering to the knife edge of the diamond knife. And then when the block comes back down, advanced by 50 or 70 nanometers, it pushes the glue, the sticky glue onto the bottom, onto the sticky glue that was left on the top, thus forming this perfect butt splice. And so each section has the same orientation, and with each cycle, the ribbon grows in length by one section. There's an interesting story here, but if I tell it, we'll never get to the end. Oh, this is a tool that has been undergoing continuous refinement. It's one of the most suave and sophisticated mechanical devices on Earth. The machine does it. You just set, you know, 50 nanometers, 70 nanometers, and you turn it on and let it go and hope nobody slams the door. So it's called an ultramicrotome, and it's literally, you know, it was invented by Porter and Bloom in the 1950s, and it, you know, churned into something completely else. But, you know, very good mechanical engineers have updated it every 5 to 10 years, and it's really good and ridiculously expensive. But, okay, so that's, you know, kind of the key special trick. Now, after we've produced our 40 millimeter ribbon, maybe 100 sections in it, we pick it up on a, this is supposed to be a cover slip. It's a regular precision glass cover slip. It's 0.17 millimeters thick. The cover slip must be absolutely just so to get diffraction limited performance. Most people have never seen diffraction limited performance at 1.4 because they don't even bother to measure the thickness of their cover slips, and nobody can make them come out right. And it's incredibly important. And if the, for the optics wonks in the audience, if the cover slip happens to be 0.16, off by less than 10%, you lose half the MTF at 1.4 Na. And that's even though the difference is made up with immersion oil. Life at Na 1.4 is unbelievably hairy. Okay, so we have this precision cover slip with a very, very clean adhesive surface on it. Actually, the workhorse right now is a very thin carbon film deposited in the vacuum, so it's both clean and smooth, and it's just right to grab the plastic very tightly. We stick it down into the water and nudge the ribbon onto the cover slip, and then gradually pick it up out of the water. And then,
the other miracle is that it doesn't fall off.
Yeah, okay, so it is, actually, it gets little wrinkles and buckles every once in a while, and we have a new version coming along that uses a gentle flow of the water to stretch them out. But it doesn't buckle. But it tends to, because you have to, first off, it's transported on a surface tension, which is, you know, pretty frictionless, and it's moved slowly, and it doesn't have much inertia. So it's almost perfect. But what we have learned recently is it helps if you put a tiny, slow-moving jet of water right down here and take it out somewhere else and just keep the water gently stretching the ribbon out. There are many fine points. Right now, this technique is good. It's got a ways to go before it's perfect. We're working on it. There's reasons to try to get it perfect. Okay, so then the next step is you take that cover slip with the ribbon stuck to it, and you mount it up in a little chamber like this, which, for those of you who know these things, it's more or less an Affygene chip. It's a closed slide that has some perfusion ports. You can flip the thing over and put solutions in and out, keep everything nice and clean. And so the solutions we normally put on it is standard four-channel indirect immunofluorescence, primary and secondary antibodies, the right matrix of species, and so we can label four proteins. Although maybe the first time we do this, we'll look at it with, we'll look at the intrinsic fluorescence of the fluorescent protein until we're tired of that, and then we kill it so we can use that channel for more immunostaining. And sometimes we use organic probes like DAPI if we want to see the DNA and where the cell nuclei are. So you can do all, you know, pretty much all of the staining tricks you've ever heard of will work on these things. By taking it down to pH 2 and just leaving it there for a while, it tends to fall apart. Or actually pH 11 will do it too. So it doesn't like really big pH changes. And some other things do like it. But okay. So we've got a slide, it's got a ribbon on it, it's got four colors of fluorescence, and then we put it on the stage of a totally off-the-shelf, modern-day, good, automated microscope. And the parts that are automated are the filters, so this is just a real-time picture with my little video camera. Here's the objective lens, there's the specimen. At you know, about this rate that you see, what it's doing is, first, in each field, it autofocuses. It does a little image-based autofocus. And then it takes a picture in color channel 1, switches the filters, does color channel 2, color channel 3, color channel 4. Meanwhile, spooling all the data off onto a hard drive. And then, after it's taken the four colors at one position, the stage moves a tiny bit, which is programmed by special software we've written to take the next picture you want to take. And here's our two favorite patterns for imaging a ribbon. First off, here is a sort of gaudily decorated ribbon. So there's a ribbon with about 10 sections out of the 100 or whatever. And if you just want to see sort of one field of the cortex with our 63x objective 300 by 200 microns roughly, you can just whiz right along and take a field from the same spot. We have a little machine vision tool that first scans the whole ribbon at low mag, figures out the right places to take the picture, and goes and take it. We don't have to think about it. And then that same tool, you flip a little switch, and this might take all night now, but now it makes a mosaic, so this would be analogous to what Clay was talking about, makes a mosaic of slightly overlapping images that covers the entire area of each section before moving on to the next one. And so you'll be seeing pictures made both of those different ways. And then finally, I mentioned the computational alignment, and here's just a small area, the acquisition gets the sections aligned pretty well. You can tell they're obviously the same sections. This one, you see it rotating, the section was curved a little bit, the glue was slightly uneven, that happens. But never mind, because the computational alignment software takes that stuff right out. And the image here is just DAPI. Well, actually, 70 nanometers is our common sweet spot. And because it worked, because it gave very stable, reliable sectioning performance. I mean, obviously, you get higher axial resolution by going to thinner sections. But this is a nice balance between the lateral resolution, giving us roughly equal voxels in all directions. So Nyquist at 1.4 is 100 nanometers. So our voxels, our native voxels, are 100 by 100 by 70. Okay, so now I described something that was a lot of trouble, and some of you may have wondered, well, what about good old confocal microscopes? So here's the answer to that question. Here are two little blocks of tissue. These are pieces of mouse brain. As a matter of fact, the white dots in both cases are synapsin 1 immunostain, so you've seen this. And the voids, you know about those. That's where there was a cell body. So this is just a small volume on the left as collected by array tomography. On the right, the very best we could do with, you know, what was at the time a state-of-the-art confocal microscope with a water objective, which is the right way to go to beat spherical aberrations on this one. And so if you look at them from the top, they are pretty similar looking, and you actually can, you can see that there's spots here. And this kind of picture has appeared many times in the literature. You just whack something with a vibratome or frozen section, stain it for synapsin or some other synaptic protein, and you can say, aha, it's punctate, must be synapses. And that's, you know, reasonable. The array tomography volume rendered from the top looks rather similar. All you can see some differences. There's more spots over here, and especially more small spots. And the big spots are smaller than the spots here. So you can think about why those are. Now we're going to take both of those volumes and render them from the side. And now we can see where array tomography really kicks butt. It's along the z-axis. So the answer on the left is the right answer. The synapses are kind of distributed at uniform average density in depth, and that's what you see. And there's big and little ones. And now if you look carefully, you can see they're slightly flattened along the z-axis. They look like little lentils. And that's because the lateral resolution is the Abbe limit at NA 1.4, 200 nanometers. The axial resolution is 70 nanometers, period, end of story, box, car, sampling. So that's why they're actually, so the resolution along the z-axis in array tomography is superior. First problem you can see is everything is, any of you who have ever collected a three-dimensional image with a confocal microscope have had your heart broken by this one. At the highest NAs, in the best you can do to correct aberrations, the point spread function that's convolved with these tiny submicroscopic synapses is about three or four times as long along the z-axis as it is in x and y. So everything is extended along the z-axis in a way that's a pure optical artifact. And as soon as you've got some spherical aberrations, which you will, always focusing into a specimen with a confocal, or you know, anything isn't perfect, or you're at a lower NA, then the point spread function gets even longer. It kind of goes as the square of, or 1 over the square of the NA, and the aberrations, the common ones like spherical, really kill you along the z-axis. So first problem is, the z-axis resolution is terrible. And if you think about it, that also hurts the z-axis sensitivity. You don't get all the photons in the right place. And then there's this other horrendous problem that the synapses appear to disappear completely after getting more than 3 or 4 microns deep in the tissue. And there's two reasons for that. The main reason is it's a problem with antibody penetration. Antibodies, you know, it's diffusion. They have a hard time percolating through fixed tissue when they have. So this is, you know, a typical result. It's somewhat dependent on the antigen and the antibody. But you know, with 2 days of incubation, you get maybe 4 or 5 microns into a piece of tissue. David. After Triton X100 extraction? Yeah. Okay, well, you extract a whole lot of stuff with Triton X. This actually was not permeabilized because we were trying to keep as many proteins as possible there. A millimeter, I mean, if you're going to say, you know, 10 or 20 microns, I mean, I know you did this with the all optical histology stuff, right? Mm-hmm. Well, okay, so here's another. Yeah. Yeah. There may well be conditions. And actually, you can see something going on here that might be part of the answer, too. As if the limited depth penetration wasn't bad enough, it's very inhomogeneous. And you can see that there's little tongues where the antibody penetration goes down farther, maybe because there were little fissures in the tissue. And if the tissue has, you know, natural openings in it, then, you know, that would be one way you could get, you know, more deeply into it. But you know, in this case, you know, there's that obvious inhomogeneity of the, and that just makes life all the more impossible in terms of quantification. Clay.
It looks sort of like both the small of the
glass
and the big one, both look, is it one section?
No.
So how many of your
are
two or more?
With 70 nanometer sections, almost all of them. In fact, we don't take very seriously anything we only see in one section. You know, it could be a little piece of contamination or something. So we tend to be pretty persnickety about seeing, you know, a synaptic punctum in more than one section. It's true there's some that are small. Also, the lentilness here, actually this was before we got in, we understood how important the cover slip and the mounting was. So this was the dark ages. This was the 2007 array tomography paper before we really understood what a serious problem spherical aberration could be in a microscope. Yeah, well, in any case, the objective is on one side of the cover slip. There's objective, oil, cover slip, section. So we actually use both an inverted and an upright, but in every case, the way to get the diffraction-limited performance is to have the specimen, the 70 nanometer section, be bonded directly to the surface of the cover slip and then look through that cover slip. If you wanted to put the sections on a slide, we started off doing this. Put it on a slide, put on some glycerol mounting medium, put on a cover slip. The thinnest you can squish the glycerol is about 10 microns, and you lose half your MTF again with an oil plan apo. So, I mean, really, the design point of an oil plan apo is something that is in intimate sort of quarter wavelength contact with a cover slip of exactly a design thickness. We do it both ways, actually, yeah. I mean, we have an upright and inverted microscope side by side. We like the upright better, but there's certain things we can do on the which, you know, have to do with, you know, real-time perfusion experiments and stuff. But it kind of doesn't matter. But what does matter is you should, if you want to get diffraction limit at 1.4, it's objective oil, 0.17 cover slip specimen right there. You can do it either way, but. Okay, so I have two more really cool things to go about the technique. And one is that, subject to some big caveats about how you prepare the tissue, but ones that are fixable, and in some cases it works just fine, you can take that array after doing your fluorescence imaging and stain it with some heavy metals and put it in a field emission scanning EM, which is a new kind of EM that has really high resolution. It's become widely adopted. This is the kind of EM that is used, for instance, in the serial block phase. Okay, you can take that array and put it in this tool, and then you can look at part of it. So this is a specimen in LR white, you know, maybe not the best resin for electron microscopy, but, you know, here is a piece of CNS neurofil. Here's like probably a piece of a cell body, a myelinated axon. You can see the myelin wrappings, the synaptic vesicles, the synaptic densities, Christie of mitochondria. This is basically at or near the 50th percentile of EM quality of, you know, good transmission EMs throughout the ages. Not the very best, not the highest resolution. This approach won't go there, but pretty damn good, and enough to measure the diameter of a 50 nanometer spine neck, no problem. But this is not a transmission EM. This is reflected electrons, rather like Anirvan was showing you. But actually, it turns out you can do better with thin sections on a low Z solid substrate than you can with the block. With the block phase, it's wonderful because everything is so clean, it's in a vacuum, you don't have to worry about contamination, and you don't even have to bother to computationally align the sections because they're naturally aligned. But there are some trade-offs in the electron imaging model due to the fact that you have to just tickle the surface in order to get an effectively thin layer. And if you crank up that SEM the way this one was cranked up to get a really good, strong, high contrast image fast, the electrons go in much too deep in the specimen, rattle around, and come back out sampling all kinds of details that confuse and blur out the image. So whereas here, with the ultra-thin section on a layer of carbon, on a layer of glass, there's no backscattering to speak of from carbon or silicon. So the electrons are simply absorbed after they go through, and all you see are the electrons elastically scattered off the stain atoms. And so here is one example, and this will be published in an upcoming paper, and this is part of the argument where we evaluated different antibodies, antigens, to see which ones agreed with the accepted gold standard for what is or isn't a synapse, which is electron microscopy. So this is just directly superimposing an optically collected image and it was on the same array, and there's a few serial sections there. Okay, now, the reason that the science has gone the way is this. This was just sort of an accidental, delightful discovery about this methodology. And it is that we can take this through one cycle and get four colors of immunofluorescence. But then what Christina figured out is we can use a stain elution method of the kind that people have been using for years to strip Western blot so they can restain them. And basically, all you have to do is change the pH. 3 units down or 3 units up, you protonate or deprotonate residues on the antibody or the antigen and disrupt the fit. And when you do that, and when you have your tissue stabilized in plastic in these very short diffusion distances within 15 minutes, the primary and the secondary antibody are just plain gone. If you put the same stains on again, you get the same answer. You can do that over and over, and you keep getting the same answer. So, why bother? Indeed. But what you actually do is you stain for four colors, put the data on the hard drive, take those antibodies off, put some different ones on, and spin those guys off into the hard drive, and everything stays aligned the same way because it was a rigid array. And so you can collect very high dimensional images. And the only trouble is evolution only gave us 3 color channels in our retinas, unfortunately. And some of us only, is there anybody here who's only got 2 that work good? Oh, sorry. I'm going to show some pictures that you aren't going to really be able to appreciate later. But anyway, here is the same thing over and over again, but mixing together a bunch of different antibodies. Fun to look at pictures like this, but if you put too many of the colors in the same frame, it just gets too confusing. It turns into color. And also, sometimes the two antibodies want to superimpose, and that's where, you've really only got 3 colors when you're starting to superimpose them. Those are pretty. They're nice for journal covers and stuff like this. This is the workhorse of our lab right now. We invented both the thing and a name for it. We call these things synaptograms. These are 2 of them. And so what they are, there's one on the left that we happen to have decided was a glutamatergic synapse, one on the right. So what the heck are these things? Well, if you look at the top here, there's section number 0-4, so it's 9 serial sections, and each row in each synaptogram represents the same volume. It's 800 nanometer cube, and it's centered around something that you choose based on your 3-dimensional image analysis. And nowadays, we usually center the synaptogram over the local maximum in 3D of a synapsin punctum. You find one of these things about every cubic micron. And we have software that goes through a volume that has 5 million synapsin local maxima in it and peels each one out and makes a synaptogram out of it. Okay, so there's, you know, synapsin. So, you know, people in my lab are, you know, really, they could probably drive cars with this kind of stereo vision now. They're really good at interpreting that as a 3D rendering of a lumpy sphere. And then down the left here, we have a whole bunch of different proteins. So in this case, this is 18 markers. It was actually 10 cycles of 4 colors each, so there were 40 markers. But we put in some redundancy for quality control. Some of them didn't give much useful information. Some of them were put in, you know, for alignment, for fine alignment between sections. But, you know, there's a bunch of interesting synaptic proteins, vesicle proteins, glutamate transporters, glutamate postsynaptic markers, including GluR2 and some NMDA subunits, some GABAergic markers, GAD, VGAT, the transporter, Jeffrin, a GABA receptor, and then tubulin and YFP. And the list goes on. We got about 100 things that work, but Clay. Yes. Good point. Well, actually, there's a kid in my lab who's trying real hard to invent the in situ version right now. And I think he's finally getting it. So here's, you know, one. If you pore over this for a while, you might say, well, this is glutamatergic, that's GABAergic. So these are synaptograms, just to make up for the fact that we don't have like 20 different kinds of cones. Yeah. No, these aren't average, and there's no preferred orientation. I mean, the synapse. This is just one. That's the same volume, different markers, the same. Yeah, but you would, and. And you know, now we're getting into the area of feature extraction, which actually I'm not going to have time to really get into. But okay, everybody got that? Okay, so now we have this height. Maybe because there's a GABA synapse right next to it, there actually is a very unexpected correlation of the position of GABA and GAD, especially in layer 4. I mean, it's not completely unexpected. It was in the literature, of course, but it's very interesting. It might be where the real destiny of nitric oxide is going to unfold, Chuck. Oh, yeah. Okay. So I'm going to go through this real fast. This is, you know, very nice state-of-the-art, but standard machine learning tools that we're using to classify, you know, there's this problem, I've already introduced it, high-dimensional data. Even if you had 17 kinds of photoreceptors, humans just aren't that good at thinking in high-dimensional space. Luckily, the mathematicians and computer scientists have come up with a class of tools, a toolkit that's incredibly wonderful. It's called machine learning tools. And they're really good at dealing with high-dimensional data. That is what they're good for. So let's see, there's some of the data that you'd hate to analyze by hand. One way to analyze it, the first thing you start off with is you go through and enumerate all those synapses and you pick some reasonable number, a couple hundred of them with a random number generator, and there's those little volumes. And you take each of those volumes and turn it into a synaptogram. This is a low order synaptogram, and you give, you know, the graduate students, the postdocs, anybody in the lab but the professor, a couple hundred of these things to look at on their lunch time, and they play a little video game, and they know something about synapses, so this is the supervised part of the machine learning. This is generating the training set. So the human looks at this one, and they see that there's VGLUT1, a little bit of it right there, and maybe some over here. So maybe that's a glutamatergic synapse. It should have a glutamate receptor. Yep, a whole bunch of GluR2, some PSD95. I'm convinced. Okay, so you push the glutamatergic button. And now the next one comes up randomly in your little stack of training set misery. And you look at this one for a while, and you notice that it's got VGAT and GAD to a transporter, a synthetic enzyme for GABA. And oh yeah, it's got a little Jeffrin there. And so you push the GABAergic button on that one and move on. And then after you've done that for a while, okay, now we've classified. So now red and blue isn't markers at all. These are just little idealized balls. We plotted them, projected them back in the image space. So that's the human-generated training set. Now you've only got 7 million to go. But what you do at this point is you hand it over to something like a support vector machine that infers what you were doing. You know, there was, besides the human looking at it, the machine was extracting feature vectors for each of those things. And the SVM classifies them according to hyperplanes that do an optimal job of separating what the human did. So there are little idealized balls. The size means something. Blue is inhibitory, and you can see there's a tendency for the cell bodies to be ringed by inhibitory synapses. Red is glutamatergic. And so, you know, you can have fun looking at stuff like that. But the point is, if you can do that, you can pull out numbers and you can measure things. And so this is a simple thing, but a thing that we really like about working on cortex. There's an axis, which is very easy to recapitulate over and over, namely depth below the pial surface. So here on two different scales, this classification of 1,300,000 synapses in terms of their density as a function of depth below the pial surface, and you can see it's actually remarkably constant, but you know, there are some interesting little ups and downs which are reasonably reproducible, and then there aren't many synapses in the white matter, although the few that there are really interesting. Yeah, we were at this stage, actually. We were being kind of conservative in the classification. We're less conservative now. Now here's a trick that I showed you a form of before, but you know, this is why we're starting to like it so much. So there's just the whole wild and woolly image with a few markers. You can see there's some YFP in there. The white was DAPI. Okay, there's the YFP alone. Now we can use a simple 3D seed fill connected component analysis, and bing, there's our dendrite. And no tracing here. You know, the resolution is inadequate to see everything, but you know, it's lumpy. That's why I was so, you know, so happy to go along with what Anirvan's reconstruction looked like. And now we're just throwing back on the synaptic markers that are near that cell. So the point is, now we can use our machine learning tools on those markers. But what's the idea here? The idea is we're trying to come up to test Smith's principle. You know, we have the diversity of all the synapses in a volume, and then our ability to have a few cells be fluorescent either genetically or because a physiologist injected dye. We can use that to parse out only the synapses that are onto a given postsynaptic cell or from, you know, a given. So now we can see how the diversity collapses or changes as we restrict our consideration to an individual cell based on that kind of image analysis. Yeah, I'll put a number on it. I think there's going to be 273 classes of glutamate synapses in the cortex. Just a wild idea. But, you know, you heard Anirvan's talk. You know, that, you know, I don't feel the burden is on my shoulders quite as much to justify that. You know, in terms of some of them, you know, may just be holdovers from development. But here's one of the things I think about evolution. When a molecule has been in your synapse for a few hundred million years, nature repurposes it and uses it for something else. And so I think, you know, those things that we might think of as developmental guidance cues are probably part of what makes it so we can write poetry. Okay, so here's some numbers that were pulled out. These are, you know, like the graphs I was showing you before, but they look different because these are metrics only for the synapses that were on the postsynaptic cell. So here's a bunch of stuff I wanted to discuss with you at length. And maybe we could still do it. You know, a synaptome, what's that? Well, it's, you know, if there's 279 kind of synapses in the cortex and they matter, which happens to be my hunch, we've got a problem. And, you know, and then if there's a continuum and they're all different and every single one is a unique individual like a snowflake, we've got an even worse problem. And what we need is ways of grappling with this. And we need, you know, I think what we need to do is first fully embrace the complexity and be overwhelmed by it and curse it, and then think about it and figure out where we can cut corners. And I think that cutting corners will be essential to doing what we all want to do someday, which is to understand how the brain works. And I think, you know, we're going to need to know circuits at the level of detail that has inspired Clay, and he was inspiring you with yesterday. And I think there's a good chance we're going to need to know about molecular diversity at that level. So, you know, complexity management, maybe I'll just stop at that one. That's one reason we might need to do it. Principles, somewhere buried in there is Smith's principle, a bunch of stuff about synapse types, and then finally the possibility, you know, that everything is a snowflake, that there's no such thing as a synapse type. But, you know, surely some rules will emerge. I mean, you know, Anirvan gave us hope as well as, you know, pointing out the problem. But, you know, the rules aren't going to emerge by any number of smart people sitting around thinking about it. They will emerge because people grapple with the data and then smart people think about it. Okay, now, I do want to do one other thing real quick first. This will take 4 minutes and 17 seconds. Not really. All we know, if the average synapse, you know, the synapse that's in all the reviews would have about 1,000.
Different kinds.
Yeah.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah, but nobody knows what an individual synapse has. Okay, now, I want to show this supplemental video, and I know everybody's starving to death, but you would be the first audience to mind this 4 minutes and 17 seconds if you minded it. And we will want it to be dark, and so this will be available. It's embargoed at the moment, but it will be available on the Neuron website on November 18th. And it's a little different kind of supplemental video. And there's two reasons it's different. One is because it has all this magnificent array tomography, and the other one is that it has an original musical score composed and performed for a commission of $50, but I gave her a $10 tip because I liked it so much, by my daughter, Catherine Rose Smith. And I just want to do a little sound check here. Okay, that'll do. Okay, now we're going to have a look at that machine I was talking about. You know, the one that is the most magnificent piece of matter in the known universe, the one that created neuroscience, math, physics, art, mistakes, blame, forgiveness, all of those things. Mr. Gray.